From WXXI News, this is Innovation Friday on Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our first connection on Innovation Friday was made in the 1980s in suburban Illinois. A young boy inserts a floppy disk to his computer. A sentence comes onto the screen. You have been awakened. Then, that blinking cursor that seemed ubiquitous at the time, the game is called Suspended, and young Michael is obsessed. 3 decades later, Michael writes, "Computer games have taught me the things that you can't learn from people." But wait a moment. In 2015, we're mired in debates about gaming culture. It's too violent at times. It desensitizes. It can be misogynistic. Well, our first guest is not here to apologize for all games, but instead to offer insight into how games impacted his own development, his own life. His new memoir is called Game Life, and we're going to talk about games from a number of different angles this hour. As always, Innovation Friday is piloted by my colleague, the editor of the Innovation Trail, Matthew Leonard. Did you grow up playing? Come on, Matthew.
Not so much, actually. I saw it more in my kids. I've got sort of kids who are now in their 20s and 30s, and I definitely saw it more both in terms of the push, pull, and resistance of just managing their behavior around that stuff, and then also sometimes, you know, definitely bonding stuff, you know, with my oldest. So yeah, but myself, I don't know, it was more I'm a bit older than you, Evan, and so it wasn't so much. I think by the time, you know, by the 80s, I was into there were other things going on in my life. But it's fantastic to be joined by Michael Clune, author of Game Life. Michael, thanks very much for spending time with us on Innovation Friday.
Of course, thanks for having me on.
Hey, so just tell us a little bit about what you kind of set out to do with, you know, with this particular book. And, you know, your first couple of books were sort of, can I say, you know, sort of more in the academic, you know, the world of academic, you know, English literature, because you're a professor of that. And then your previous book before this was a kind of reflection on your own experience of heroin addiction. And now Game Life, which is what?
Well, so yeah, with Game Life, what I wanted to do is I wanted to tell the story of my childhood. And I tried it for a while in different ways, and it just wasn't working. And then I sort of thought, you know, the images of the games I played when I was a kid kept coming back to me. I had these very vivid memories of those games. So I began writing about my experiences with those games. And what happened was, each of those games gave me a kind of lens into capturing a part of my childhood that I didn't have any other way to write about. And what I mean by that is the part of my childhood that wasn't involved with relationships or with other people so much, but that was solitary. And I write about the way that computer games both shaped and kind of aided my childhood imagination as it developed.
Now, to the extent that, you know, that experience of those kind of ubiquitous environments was shared by potentially millions of other people, what is it about your own personal experience within the landscapes of, you know, computer games and video games that you think is somehow unique to what other people might have experienced?
Well, it's a good question. The first thing is, I'm not sure that what I experienced was unique, but I do think that, you know, when I was looking around and at the literature, there was very little writing or reflecting on people's, what I call in the book, our intimate lives with computer games. People tended to be sort of ashamed about their game playing, or when they would talk about it, you know, there's a vibrant online and in books and other places discussions of games, but they tended to really talk about the games themselves and never about how we as individuals were transformed by those games. Mm-hmm. So what I wanted to do was, in telling this story, to give people a language or a vocabulary for starting to explore their own lives with computer games, because, I mean, you know, it's a really significant fact. I'm 40 years old, and I belong to the first generation, basically, that was raised with this kind of technology as a key and integral part of my development. And so I think that's an important story to tell.
You and me both, brother. Michael and I are around the same age with around the same sort of gaming experience, with my own mother telling me that if you want to play Might and Magic 2, you've got an hour. And I said, Mom, there's not enough. Might and Magic 2 requires a lot more time than just an hour. But we've had Michael Klune, we've had a lot of people on Twitter when I mentioned sort of the genre of games we're going to talk about. Let me just entertain our Twitter users who are asking if you played the following, and this will give you a sense, if you're listening, some of the games we're talking about. Ultima, yes or no?
Oh, yes, all of them.
Okay, yes. Okay, Ultima, a game called Myst.
Yes, okay. I played Myst. I thought it looked beautiful, and I just could not get anywhere with it.
The same way, I hit a wall. I don't think anybody ever solved Myst. Maybe if I'm wrong, call the program and tell us how wrong I am about that. Might and Magic, yes. Bard's Tale, yes?
Oh, yes, yeah, all the Bard's Tales. I love Bard's Tales.
Okay, and then our listeners want to know if you played Civilization and SimCity.
Yeah, you know, Civilization, I've probably played more than any other single game. And I didn't write about it just because, you know, I tried to write it about it a number of times and it just wasn't working. But maybe it's because I played it for so long, over so many years and so many iterations of the series. But, yeah, I'm a huge fan of Civilization. I never got into SimCity. I don't know what it was, but I'm just, like, totally not interested in sewers and all the other kinds of stuff that you've got to play with in SimCity. That's just me. I know a lot of people love it, but never could get into it.
So this is the genre we're talking about. And so in my own gaming experience, Michael, as much as I've been able to read into your book, and I can't wait to finish reading your book and some of the comments I've seen, I sense that we agree on this, but let me ask. I was pushed away from gaming when it became much more realistic, when it was a lot less use of the imagination and much more overt, with better graphics and sometimes more visceral, more violent. I appreciated the RPGs, the role-playing games, the kinds that did require a long time but also required you to think and use your imagination. Do you agree? Or did you feel pushed away at all when games started to evolve in terms of graphics and kind of the sensory overload?
Yeah, you know, that's a great question. What I'll say about that is, for me, the magic of those early games, right, the Bard's Tale type games, the Ultima type games, Baldur's Gates, you know, all of those, it was the minimal nature, and I read a lot about, you know, the sort of ways they would try to give this quasi-3D with using wireframe technology in the case of a game called Elite, a fabulous game from the 80s. And I felt that with the big-budget, graphic-heavy blockbusters, I did miss something, you know. But let me say this also. I feel like right now we're at an era where a lot of computer game designers are going back to what made those kinds of games so powerful, and re-engaging with that. I mean, if you take Minecraft, which is probably the most popular game in the world, it is not spectacular graphics, and yet it's got that kind of immersive magic that draws people in. Or think of a recent game that I thought was great called Pillars of Eternity, which is a reimagining of the sort of Baldur's Gate 2 type of RPG from the late 90s, early 2000s, and which has been very successful. So yes, I absolutely agree, but I do think that the industry is starting to respond to that absence that folks like you and I feel.
That's interesting. And for listeners, if you want to call the program and weigh in with our guest, Michael Klune, an English professor at Case Western and the author of the new memoir, Game Life, you can call the program at 844-295-TALK. It's toll-free, 844-295-8255, or 263-WXXI, 263-9994. Gaming can be sort of monolithically talked about, unfortunately, because it's a lot more diverse than that. And that's part of what the discussion this hour is about. Trust me, it's not just going to be me geeking out about Ultima and Final Fantasy and everything else. but listeners, I'd love to hear from you if you either want to share your own experiences about the way gaming impacted you, especially in this kind of genre, or the way you view it in context with your kids, for example. And Minecraft is interesting because it is divisive for some families. Kids will play hours on it, and you're right, it's sort of rudimentary graphics. I don't fully understand it yet, Michael, but it is much more of a throwback, I guess, right?
In a way it is. And, you know, talking about diversity and the kind of more diverse audience that we're seeing with games right now, you know, my girlfriend is the you know in my house is the one who really loves Minecraft. And so we've seen, you know, more and more women especially entering into the world of gaming. And you know, one of the things I wanted to do with this book also was by thinking about how gaming, you know, impacted the emotional and imaginative aspects of my life. I wanted to sort of move it away from, you know, where a lot of geek culture sometimes gets stuck, which is just sort of, yeah, like geeking out over, you know, the specs or the descriptions of the plots or the graphics or whatever. That's cool. I get into that too. But there's another dimension or element. And, you know, sometimes, and people have had sort of, it's been controversial in some areas that I've tried to open up this aspect of gaming. Some people feel threatened by it. But for me, you know, we're at an era where gaming is no longer in this just confined to a small section of society, and you know, we need to find new perspectives, new ways of thinking about it and criticizing, but also taking it seriously as you know, this key part of many people's lives.
Michael, hi. Yeah, Matthew Leonard again. And just looking at some of the kind of really enormous life events that went on in your own real life around the same time that you were immersed in these games. I mean, things like the divorce of your parents, which you talk about in the book, and, you know, obviously the kind of really intense emotional and physical changes that we know go on through, you know, through, say, adolescence. What sort of environment or space did the video games provide for you in light of those really big events, say your parents' divorce? What, you know, what happened in the game space, you know, as a result of those really big external pressures in the real world?
Yeah, that's a great question. And, you know, one of the things that this is part of why I chose to write about games, because I was 12 years old when my 12 and 13 when my parents got divorced. And at that time, and I think many kids who have that situation can relate to this, I didn't necessarily, if you had asked me at the time what I was feeling or thinking, I just wouldn't have said anything. I wasn't really consciously processing it. But my reaction to divorce was coming out in other ways. And my engagement with the games, you know, it came out. I was discovering in the games really a way of dealing with my solitude. I felt all of a sudden, with the collapse of my family, really isolated and really alone. And on the one hand, you could say, well, games are a form of escapism. Maybe I was escaping from that difficult circumstance by playing games. And I don't think that's wrong. But I think what I was escaping to is something more complicated and richer than we ordinarily mean when we use the word escape or escapism. And what I mean by that is that the games taught me that my solitude could be this sort of rich and multidimensional space. It wasn't a completely blank space, a space of feeling cold and abandoned. It was rather a space where there were feelings of anxiety and depression, but there were also glimpses of different kinds of experiences that I could open up. So, looking at that experience of the divorce, which again is a pretty ubiquitous experience for people in my generation, divorce rate has gone down recently, but it really kind of spiked around late 80s, early 90s. Writing about that experience through games gave me a way of really tapping into the emotional life of what I was going through, which I really couldn't have articulated consciously.
And what about this idea that, you know, perhaps within the mastery of a game that you establish some sense of control, order, achievement, and satisfaction that, you know, isn't operating in the chaos of say a separating family?
Well, that's a great question, and one of the things that I talk about is a lot of the games I played, and Might and Magic was one of them, I really was never able to finish. They were like really hard, and I there was a level of control, but there was also a lot of blockage, right?
Yeah.
And so what I talk about in Might and Magic is I kept on getting stuck, and the feeling of being stuck in the game had this interesting relationship to the feeling of being stuck in real life, in my social life, in middle school, dealing with my parents. But dealing with the feeling of being stuck in the game and I read about this, I started looking at just the way the clouds and the sky was represented in the game. And I would spend, you know, half an hour at the time just admiring the beauty of the sky. And it's a really strange thing to say, but in a way, the game gave me an appreciation for something like nature, something that could take me out of my feelings of frustration, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
So it wasn't quite the idea that I was able to control in the games what I wasn't able to control in life. It was more my own experience was the frustrations in the games gave me a way of dealing consciously with the frustration that I wasn't able to deal with consciously in life.
And you seem to be suggesting also just developing a concept of an inner life anyway, and an inner life that wasn't necessarily just being stimulated by the activities that are the game, but were also a place where, you know, things that you would reflect on later or that you would carry over into other parts of your day or week.
Yes, exactly. Yes, I definitely think it was, the things that have meant the most to me in my life. Literature is number one, and games are probably number two. And in some ways, in writing this book, what I was doing was trying to write a work of literature that is processing what happens in games. So it's a kind of fusion of literature and games. And the development of inner life, that's the story I'm trying to tell.
Well, the storytelling of games, right? I mean, I guess that's where the convergence is. But just before Evan brings in a point, I was just going to ask you about this. For me, when I was kind of reading about your book and reading parts of your book and looking, just thinking around existentialism and thinking around, you know, just the whole existential dilemma and, you know, the concept of being alone, having to make sense. I mean, is that something that, you know, perhaps now, you know, later in your academic life, working in literature, that you also sort of see infuse some of this life experience?
Absolutely. Yes. Yeah. For sure. Yeah. I mean, it is, you know, games offer a very stripped-down existential experience in some ways. I mean, I read a lot about the experience of death in games, which is kind of uncanny. I mean, in one hand, it's very sort of mechanical. You die, you press a button, and you get reborn. But then on the other hand, it is this sort of uncanny feeling this interruption in this life that you've been living. And, and I read about in the first chapter, when I was seven, my first real grappling with the concept of death came through one of those early text-based adventure games, a game called Suspended. It had a really big impact on me. So, I think existentialist, you know, basic life issues about what success means, about what death means, these kinds of issues, I process them through games before I did through a kind of social environment.
We're talking to Michael Clune, who is the author of a new memoir. He's an English professor at Case Western, and he's the author of Game Life. And we are seeing a pile of comments come in on our social media feeds on Twitter, and I'm going to be getting to some of your comments there in just a moment. But I want to just read a brief snippet from the review of the book. The reviews are very, very good, and this is from the Buffalo News. And Ben Siegel writes, "Game Life feels definitive and memorable. Clune reminds us that we're in a more important era than we realize, that these games are not for nerds, but for explorers. They're not about beating the undefeated, but besting yourself, seeing yourself in rhetorical fables, in binary operations with moralistic consequences. It's Shakespearean in the same way that chess is philosophical." What a great review, Michael. And I'm curious, when you talk about working through your divorce or the divorce in your family, sort of the breakup of your family, was there a single game that you sort of spent a lot more time on there that stands out to you, not just for the thrill of playing, but for whatever reason at that time in your life stood out as a place to go?
Yeah, well, there's a couple of them, because the divorce was sort of protracted, the divorce and its aftermath. But one of them was this game, Elite, which has been remade just in the last year and released under the title of Elite Dangerous. But Elite was this early space exploration, space trading game. And what was remarkable about it is it had what are called wireframe graphics. So there were no solid surfaces. It was just sort of sketches of planets and spaceships done in white lines against the black space background. And, you know, it gave a kind of quasi-3D, which was really remarkable. But something about the experience of moving around a world where you could see through all the surfaces has this uncanny resonance for me. And when I think about it years later, and I think about those years of the divorce and so forth, that's the image. That's sort of the emotional and visual texture of that time for me is the experience of manipulating and moving through this really uncanny environment. And it's one of those things that, okay, the designers may have been trying to imitate real 3D, but in doing so, they actually created something that was completely unlike our experience of the real world and fascinatingly different. And so if I had to name one that really captured that time for me, it was that game. Really, really interesting game.
In our remaining time with Michael, we're not just going to focus on the games back then, but also on where gaming sort of has been going. And again, you can't really speak about it monolithically. There's a lot of things going on. One of our listeners writes to us, "I checked off every game you've listed, and yes, I even beat Myst. My personal epiphany came from gaming when I was playing World of Warcraft. I peaked as player number 2 on my server, and I saw the sliding scale of achievement that many modern games are based around. So many of them require such an intense amount of time and effort, I became disillusioned, and I stopped playing cold turkey when I realized I was getting nothing out of it anymore. I have never looked back." It's an interesting comment, Michael. I mean, essentially saying modern games don't offer that same value in some way. And I'm curious to know if that's too bifurcated a statement or if you agree.
I would agree with what that that commenter, that listener just said. He or she is talking about a genre called, sometimes called, massive online games. Massive online multiplayer games, and World of Warcraft is sort of the marquee title there. I never played those games. I read about them, I learned about them, but I just sort of instinctively felt that that wasn't going to do it for me. A lot of the experience in those games is what's called grinding, which means you put in a huge amount of effort to try to move up, as the commenter said eloquently, as you try to move up this ladder. And to me, that's like a job, like a bad job. You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah.
I feel like we get enough of that kind of stuff in our real life. Why would I want to do that in my off time? So that genre of games really has never appealed to me. And it raises a good question, because when I talk about games, it's not sort of, and you mentioned this also in your comments, I'm not trying to make a statement about games as such. I think we need, just as with literature, there's good and bad literature, with movies or anything else, this medium has all kinds of different things to offer. And, you know, some people will disagree, and I'd love to hear from people who think, no, you know, the World of Warcraft, that's an amazing game. It does all these amazing things for me. But that's not been my experience, and I would agree, and it sounds like it was the experience of this listener.
Logan on Twitter writes to us, "Gaming started my passion for computing and led to my degree at RIT and a career as a programmer. And by the way, I also loved Heroes of Might and Magic too." So Logan's talking about not only love of gaming as a child, but building into a career. And our outstanding staff here, John Andrus and Gene Fisher and the great people who work with us here, point out, by the way, that gaming's introduced a new generation to classical music. There are a number of brilliant young composers writing music for games now, and the RPO is going to play a concert of music from Final Fantasy on October 29th. So, you know, it's not just, and I'm sure game life is this way too, Michael. This is not just a book about, well, life was better in the 80s. It's a little more complex than that.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I think gaming culture is in a really exciting place right now. And if I'm looking at in the book sort of the roots of that culture in the 80s, where it's come since then, it really has become very diverse. And there are so many different, really fascinating, independent game designers who are doing, incorporating classical music, incorporating experimental art. You know, there's a lot of really exciting things happening out there right now. So, I think it all started with those kinds of games, and it's exciting to see where it's gone.
Michael, just a couple more minutes before we let you go, and thanks for being with us. But I'm just wondering, often, I'm just sort of thinking about the way in which often the kind of civil discussions around computer games, video games, and representation in the media is often incredibly negative, and it often comes up when we're talking about that sort of great American archetype, the American loner, Adam Lanza, when they talk about, you know, lone shooters and those kinds of people, inevitably they start to dig back and they start to make all of these links between, extreme violent behavior, and then they try and, forge some connection to, what their interests were in Grand Theft Auto or whatever it was. How have you reflected on that and, reflected on that discussion and just how video games tend, in my experience, the conversations around video gaming just tend to be overwhelmingly negative.
Yeah, that's right. And, one thing to point out about that, and this is something as a scholar of literature, you just find that basic model of people wanting to blame social ills on a particular fictional art form. It goes back to Plato. Plato, right, wanted to ban all poets from his ideal society, right, because he felt that poetry and fiction caused people to lose control of their emotions, to become overly violent, become overly reactive. And he wanted to ban all literature except for works praising great leaders, right? So,
right.
So this has a very long history. It was music also in the 1980s. Heavy metal and so forth was, when I was growing up, was demonized. Dungeons and Dragons.
Typical.
So we need to put that in context. Like, this is a reaction that people have always had. The social scientific evidence on this is really not there, according to some of the studies and some of the my colleagues who work on these on these issues. That said, there is the idea of the loner and the question of violence. It is kind of an intriguing question. I definitely wouldn't blame games for it. And I think the media reaction has been completely unhelpful and hyperbolic and overblown in basically every way. But it's interesting. If you're, there's a review in the New York Review of Books that just came out about my book. It actually talks at the end about Adam Lanza, and it says that the game that he, and this is a guy named Gabriel Winslow Yost who wrote this review, and it's kind of really interesting. And he did some research and found out that the game that Adam Lanza played the most and loved the most was a game called Dance Dance Revolution, and apparently he would play this for hours at the local theater, and when this guy writes about it, he says, shows us this other aspect of this very dark individual, and maybe opens up his inner life in a way that that we otherwise wouldn't have access to.
Yeah.
So it's a complicated question, but I would strongly disagree with the knee-jerk reaction that wants to blame social ills or the problem. If you're worried about these shootings, you should do something about guns. You know what I mean? Like gun control.
Right. And we've got a link to that New York Review of Books review, actually, by the way, on the Innovation Trail and WXX Design User's website. And final question for you, Michael Clune. Did your life as a gamer make you a more spiritual person?
Yes, I think it did. Yes. And the contemplative moments in many of the games I played, the meditative rhythms of lots of those games, I think it laid the groundwork for who I am today. I practice Zen Buddhism and I meditate every day. And it might sound strange to people to think of, wow, this love of gaming sort of evolved into a kind of a meditative practice. But that has been my experience, and I'm guessing I'm not alone in that. And hopefully there's other people out there who can relate to that kind of spiritual dimension to gaming.
Remarkable. And my last question for you, Michael, is as a parent now, I'm going to eventually be in the position of having to decide what I think is appropriate for my son and what's not. And I happen to think that Civilization was the greatest educational game of all time. Not that I've played every game of all time, but the greatest I ever came across. It made me want to learn more about the world. I loved playing it. Like you, I've probably played more Civilization than any other game that I played growing up. Is Civilization still out there, by the way? And what do you like for parents who want really great educational games for kids these days?
Well, what I would say is, the first thing I would say is educational games are fine and good, and I do write about those a little bit, but games are really about fun. And if I want to do anything in this book is I want to show that while we think of fun as something devoid of higher interest, there's a kind of benefit, and a real benefit, a psychological, spiritual, cultural benefit to some of the games, to the way that games allow you to immerse yourself in these other aspects of yourself, of your inner self. And so I encourage parents to let the kids play the games they like. and then just limit the time that they're doing it. I was always limited when I was growing up to about 2 hours a day at games. And since I didn't watch TV, I always hated TV. You know, games never really interfered with my love of reading, for example, or with various other aspects of my life. I do think, you know, as much as I'm pro games in lots of ways, I do think, you know, it is possible to have an addictive relationship to games and to other kinds of media, right? So, you know, I think that's where I would go if I was talking about parenting in games, is limit the exposure, but let the kid choose what games they want to play, and then let them reflect on it. Maybe ask them about what their experience is like there. Ask them to reflect on it. I think that might be more interesting in some ways than a kind of classic educational game that will take the place of the history book.
Well, Bob and many other people writing the program about how much they loved this conversation. He says, great show, brings back memories. A couple early games that captured his imagination were Mystery House and Wizardry. He still has original copies of both of those. And he says,
that'll be worth a bit now.
Thanks for those conversations. And Michael Kloon, the author of the book that is available now called Game Life. Thank you, Michael.
Thank you so much.
All right, let's get a short break, and we're going to continue the discussion on gaming with a couple of guests in studio after the short break right here on Innovation Friday. Coming up in our second hour, taxation from a number of different angles. If you hate paying taxes, or even if you don't mind taxes, this is the kind of hour that should illuminate things from a couple of different angles. First of all, hidden debt on the state level. How is it impacting the taxes you pay? And then, how to work toward a fairer taxation system. We're covering it next hour on Innovation Friday.
This is WXXI AM Rochester, WRUR FM and HD Rochester, WEOS FM and HD Geneva, and WXXI FM HD2 Rochester.
Support for your public radio station comes from our members and from the Hochstein School of Music and Dance, welcoming students of all ages to explore music and dance in an environment designed to nurture creativity, offering lessons, group classes, short courses, and ensembles. To learn more, visit hochstein.org. And Ralph Honda, serving Rochester since 1933, offering new and pre-owned vehicles, including the 2016 Accord Family Sedan. Ralph Honda, Honda done right. RalphHonda.com.
Welcome back to Connections. It's Innovation Friday. I'm Evan Dawson, always joined on Innovation Friday by Matthew Leonard, the editor of the Innovation Trail, InnovationTrail.org, and the network of reporters who do such great work for us and for Matthew, and he has helped coordinate another great show. I loved that conversation with Michael Kloon, and yeah, we have a logical extension now with some guests
right
in studio.
Well, so looking further, I mean, one of the implications of the book was also looking at this whole area of gamification. So one of the, you know, some of the statistics that come up about, you know, you've got more than 150 million Americans spending, you know, tens of billions of dollars a year on video games, and yet there are people who perhaps don't have any game experience, people of certain generation, or, you know, who are still being influenced by the culture of games and what we call gamification. And to kind of help us navigate that and to reflect on the conversation we had with Michael Kloon, we've got a couple of guests from the Strong National Museum of Play, J.P. Dyson, who's the director, and Jeremy Saucier, who's the assistant director of the International Center for the History of Electronic Games, which is a fantastic thing and a really important national asset and archive. Thanks very much for being in studio with us. And what was your initial reaction? I'd be interested to get your kind of feedback on the conversation with Michael Kloon and the kinds of things he touched on there.
Well, first of all, as someone who's about his age, maybe a little bit older, and Jeremy's a little bit younger, as first of all, resonated with a lot of the games he played and that experience that he talked about. And I think one of the common things that when you talk to people about this is that period of your own life when you experience these games, because that period, especially of adolescence, is such a key emotional piece. And it really is very formative in terms of shaping how you view not only games, but also life in general. And I think that's interesting both from in the ways that he was talking about how the games colored his own view of life, whether that's from spirituality or how you overcome problems, but also getting into this broader issue of gamification and people's common experience of gaming. What you're really seeing is a generational turnover, where every new generation coming up has grown up playing games. They're gamers. And so you're seeing these modes of dealing with the world that they learn from playing games manifesting themselves in a lot of other areas of life as well.
Right. So, and we're going to talk about those a little bit in a little bit more detail. I mean, things like business, education, obviously, we started to touch on that. But just a statistic I think is a little bit out of date now even, is that 70% of all corporations in the world have some game-based app that they use to connect to their market, their consumers, or whatever. So we're all being touched by that when we're, you know, going through some, you know, going through some sort of mobile app or whatever. Jeremy, what were your kind of thoughts?
Yeah, I you know, kind of agree with JP there that you know, listening to Michael talk about his experiences with games, that you can't help but think about your own experiences. I am a little bit younger than the other people in the room here, and but I did grow up playing the Sierra games, like Mystery House, King's Quest, and had that kind of relationship that Michael talked about. Came from a little bit of a dysfunctional home, so I think for me, play was not so much an escape as it was another space for me. And so seeing, you know, and hearing Michael talk about the way that he sort of harnessed games in that way certainly relates to my own experiences.
And in what sense, I mean, it's clear that that video gaming changed our conception of play in a really significant way. And obviously at the museum you'd be thinking about those ideas as curators. What are some thoughts that you'd throw out there in terms of how it kind of changed the notion of play and childhood even?
I think a couple of things. First of all, I think you always see continuity and change. So he mentioned a game like SimCity, for instance, which he didn't take out. Well, it's very much like the sort of play you might do if you're building a model railroad. But in the same way, you introduce new forms of play, so or new opportunities. So, again, a lot of the games he talked about were these fantasy role-playing games. And they go back to older games like Dungeons & Dragons, but then there's this chance to play with a computer as opposed to getting together with a group of people. And so what are the ways that this sort of, the play is the same, but just maybe a slightly different format? And what is it totally new that it's something you could never do before, these endless worlds that you can be in? Or this chance to play solo, and what are the implications for that? I think those are a lot of the questions we deal with at the museum as we think about the consequences of these games. And now as games are becoming mobile, they're in your pocket, you're being connected with people across the world. Yeah. What does that mean for things like community? What does it mean if you're playing online in a game and some of your best friends are online? Is that the same thing as having a best friends who are playing in your living room together?
Right.
I have like this blob of thoughts that sort of feel related, and I'm just gonna but I've been thinking about all the different themes, especially when Matthew was talking with Michael Clune about the question on the negative association people often have with gaming, especially in regards to violence, and the impetus to go back and try to find connections there. And what Michael's saying, and I think Matthew, I mean, I haven't delved into the research, but I think he's right from what I've seen. In general, research does not bear out violent behavior connected to gaming from what I've seen. That's
my broad understanding of the literature.
Okay.
As well. Is that your understanding as well?
Yes, that's our understanding as well. There's absolutely, when you look at people like Adam Lanza, and other sort of lone wolves or people involved in these horrible acts of violence, there's actually never been any connection, real connection made between the two.
All right, and so it doesn't mean that it makes me all that comfortable with Grand Theft Auto anyway. Yeah, and so I have this interesting kind of dissonance because when I was growing up, yeah, I played Might and Magic 2, and my mother thought, boy, that game is the worst. It's going to, you know, it's taking up a lot of time, et cetera, et cetera. But, you know, if my son grows up and plays games like Civilization now, I'm going to limit the time. I want him outside as much as we can. That's my biggest concern with gaming, is I do want kids outside more. But Civilization games, those kind of things that can be educational, can be really helpful and can spur a desire to be educated, et cetera. So do I just have to get used to saying the research doesn't bear it out, but I still don't like the violent games? I mean, like, can't we do it a better way?
Well, you can, you can dislike the violent games. I mean, one of the things that Michael and that we've all been talking about here is that there's a broad spectrum of games and there's a broad spectrum of gaming culture. And so on the one hand, you might have, a game like Grand Theft Auto 5, which has some distasteful kind of play in it. The other thing you want to think about is that, you know, is that something that you want a 10-year-old to play? Well, if you go back to Michael talking about, he's really the first part of this first generation of people who grew up playing these games. Well, then you've got to think that a 40-year-old may want to play something different than Pac-Man. He may want to play Pac-Man, but he may also want to play Grand Theft Auto.
Well, he may want to walk on the dark side of something or whatever, you know. So, but and a lot of it, I think, a lot of what gets conflated. I'm thinking of the was it the Hackergate? There was something where there was a really strong social media attack on a female gamer.
Gamergate.
And that was more about social media behavior and kind of, you know, adolescent misogyny, really, than it was about the games themselves. It was, you know, it was really so. And this is a thing, you know, I mean, there aren't a lot of women in startups either, you know. So there's a similar gender issue in a lot of areas of technology based, you know, development. So, but I wanted to move it on and just sort of look at how you see the games that you have in the archive kind of as ways to understand things like interactive technology and the way that we experience the world now. I mean, how do you, you know, do they form some sort of, bridge of technology and logic and interactivity that we're now seeing really in ways that maybe are completely unrelated to the game world they came from?
Right. So the Strong Museum has the world's largest collection of video games related artifacts. We have more than 55,000 objects. It's a massive collection. And one of the things, the key elements there, I think, for instance, is something that came up earlier, is about how games are a sort of a gateway into high tech technology. The idea of a digital native. And how do you learn to be a digital native? Well, how do children learn to speak a native language? They do it through the casual, playful interaction one with another. And games have always been this medium for introducing people into the digital world. This goes back to, if you remember, with Windows Solitaire in Windows 3.0, one of its purposes was to teach people how to use a mouse, which was a strange device. Well, now everyone knows how to use a mouse. But by playing a game was a great way to do it. And so games are both means by which society changes, but they're also then, too, as well, reflections of how society is changing. So they're both action and reflection at the same time, and that's what we try to interpret at the museum.
Right. Just joining us as well is Deborah Gears, who's an associate professor at RIT's the Golisano College of Computing and Information Sciences, Department of Information, Science and Technologies. Deb, thank you very much for joining us. We've been having a conversation really initially starting in a kind of a nostalgic bloom of game experience in the 80s, but we've kind of shifted the conversation on now to looking at how the gaming experience and our understanding of game design influences other areas of our life that maybe aren't connected to gaming. Could you tell us what you're doing and what your kind of interest is in this idea of, you know, this process of gamification?
Certainly, and thank you for the invitation. Yes, I became interested in gamification a few years ago. That was basically the result of working on a PhD to study volitional behavior in wikis and recognizing, you know, the success that Wikipedia has had. Well, what happens inside an organization?
Just remind us what a wiki is for folks who maybe aren't.
A wiki is basically it's an open forum where people can add content, and they can together work on developing content together. They can talk about content in terms of coming to consensus about what an item should be. And Wikipedia is currently the number 5 most popular website, which is an excellent example of a wiki, where you have hundreds and thousands of editors around the world that are contributing their knowledge to these knowledge repositories. And they do so without knowing basically who's on the other end. And so it's an interesting, it's a very interesting study, I will say. But that led me to learn more about solving business problems using this notion of gamification. I spent a lot of time in industry as well and have been in academia for about 15 years now. So I understand that the problems in business are serious, right? And who's going to play games in business? But you need this level of volitional participation, so, you know, people contributing to solving of problems. But gamification, loosely speaking, let me first define that and how it's being interpreted. Gamification, loosely speaking, is the application of game elements in non-game contexts and typically does not result in a game. Okay? So typically people play games because they want to, not because they have to.
Right.
So we and I am trying to understand those game elements that prompt people to into action, to work towards solving this particular problem.
Right. So in the game context, you might have rewards where you're chasing the gorilla and you want to get the pot of honey, or you get
exactly.
a berry or whatever, and that's kind of a motivation for your action. But in the gamification world, we're trying to unlock other things that are actually human desires, right? Because I think you know things like competition, achievement, status, self-expression, those 16 desires or whatever they're called, the Reese model. Yeah.
You bring up a very good point, and you've been doing some background reading, I can see, in some of my work. Now, what's happening, gamification, I think, is defined differently by different people. And in the research area, we're still trying to understand what that definition is, truly. And it's being used strongly by companies who are marketing this as a marketable item, and they do. They look at points, leaderboards, achievements, leveling as a means to stir up competition. And you mentioned Dr. Stephen Reese's theory of 16 basic desires, and that's what I use to try to understand people in a work environment. So what motivates a researcher? What motivates a sales manager? What motivates a frontline worker? And there are means to do that. But others are applying gamification, thinking that, well, the primary motivation is competition or achievement or extrinsic rewards. So in the context that I've been studying gamification, I'm more interested in the intrinsic rewards and trying to then understand what motivates. So here at RIT, I've been part of a three-year study and learned that of the 16 basic desires that Dr. Stephen Reese has been working on for over three decades, curiosity, idealism, and honor were the top three off the charts motivators for researchers. So I worked to design a solution that is, I have inserted some game elements basically that make the experience a bit more fun. Some of them are very subtle. But in essence, it is a more enjoyable experience. And so we want people to engage in something that is fun and rewarding. And in our case, we're trying to increase level of collaboration across our RIT campus.
Right. Thanks for that. I just want to bring in J.P. Dyson and Jeremy Saucier from the Strong National Museum of Play just to reflect a little bit on what you've shared with us, Deborah,
sure.
Which, you know, includes this idea of, you know, curiosity, idealism, and honor. And I just wonder, they're three big themes that I think are in the gaming world as well, right?
Exactly. I mean, those are all key elements in a lot of games. I mean, you see yourself as a hero who's going to uphold the honor as you go and exploring these places for these noble goods. I think I got curiosity, idealism, and honor all in there.
There you go.
And that is a key thing. You know, one thing I'd be interested in hearing a little bit about is how Deb thinks about the relationship between gamification and play. Because one thing about play is play tends to be voluntary, and I think you might have mentioned this. Mm-hmm. So what happens when a company decides to use game elements in a way that's maybe not voluntary, that's maybe designed to manipulate the person? I think that's one of the things that people struggle with, this gamification idea, and think, how is it applied in the best way? And people have a lot of different thoughts on that, and I'm sure it's something she thought deeply
and
about.
And Deb, we're down to about our last 2 minutes. Go ahead, Deb.
That is a fantastic question. Because there's another theory that I use, and we want participation, basically, to be volitional. And the study that I did for my dissertation suggested that when you make it a requirement, for some people it may prompt them to participate because they were afraid of the technology, unsure about what they were supposed to do. In others, it diminished their desire to continue working in whatever capacity they're required to do. So I've been also using another theory, the self-determination theory, along with collaborative engagement patterns that I learned from my study, to try to create a context that promotes volitional participation and doesn't punish people for not participating. You brought up the comparison between playfulness and gamefulness, and that's an important distinction. We think about gamification as being gameful and not playful. You think about playful in terms of building blocks. You know, someone has blocks, and it's fun to put them and assemble them together and make new things and be creative. But there's really no goal other than enjoyment, having fun, building a you know, a building or a store or a fence or whatever. But game is different because there are rules and there are goals. There are different defining factors in the game space. So your question was extremely astute and a difficult one to answer in 2 minutes.
Well, you did very well, and we've got a whole 50 seconds left. But quickly, Deborah, as well, is gamification just more than a fad? I mean, is this something that's really going to shift the needle on things? Like, I know, say, in the human resources area, things like just onboarding and selecting people for new ventures and things, gamification plays a role as well. So you can try a 30-second answer now.
Okay, well, I think that it is not a fad, but it is being considered a fad in some areas that, in the manner that's being implied, applied generically, badges, mm-hmm. leaderboards, those kinds of things.
Right.
And it also conflicts a little bit with the definition of serious games, which is a game that could help learning and could help people learn policy and things like that. Gamification is more complicated, I think, in a business area.
And a topic we clearly have to come back and talk more about.
Okay. Well, thank you so much.
We do, Matthew. We had a number of comments. Dan wrote a comment saying he's a little concerned about addictive nature of games and feels like, you know, that was sort of overlooked this hour. There's a lot of layers here. And to Dan's point and many others, let's come back to it sometime. Let's do that.
Sounds good.
In the meantime, you can go out to the Strong Museum of Play.
Absolutely.
And hang out with these guys here. So
those guys being J.P. Dyson, the director, and Jeremy Saucier, assistant director of the International Center for History of Electronic Games. Fantastic resource. Please get out and support the Strong National Museum of Play. And you're also listening to Deborah Gears from the Golisano College of Computing and Information Sciences, etc.
cheers, everyone. Thank you.
Thanks for the
conversation. Thanks, gentlemen. We'll see you at the Strong. John Boehner's announcement in about 90 seconds right here on your NPR affiliate.